So today we're going to be reading out Sutta number 9, which is the Sammāditti Sutta, and it's unlike you. It's a very all-encompassing sutta in particular. It deals with the first time in the Majjhima, dealing with dependent origination, and the 12 links, which show just how rebirth happens without a soul, and also that in each particular case, he brings into the fourfold analysis of phenomena when he first met with the Four Noble Truths, you know, the thing, exactly what it is, and why it is, in other words, what causes it, the fact that it does actually cease, it has a cessation, and how the cessation is brought about, the fourfold analysis of all these things. So, it is the Sammāditti Sutta. And this is, again, a sutta which was not spoken by the Buddha, it was spoken by Venerable Sariputta. So not all of the teachings here were mentioned by the Buddha. They are mostly the Buddha's teachings, but also the chief disciples as well.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
Here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sāvatthī in Jetu's grove and Nātapindika's park. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks thus, "Friends, monks, friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this, "One of right view, one of right view," he said, "friends. In what way is a noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" And that's a euphemism, a metaphor for the stream winner. And another, they have many ways of describing the streamer or the sotapanna. One of them is someone who's ditti sampanno, who's attained the right view. And whenever we have the word just ditti mentioned alone in the suttas, it usually means right view. And they usually, if it's wrong view, they're called miccha ditti. We have to be careful because, like the Thai language, anyone who has ditti is usually the wrong form of view. So in Thai, if you hear someone has ditti, it always means wrong view.
That's the same in Myanmar.
Yeah,
the default is ditti.
That's right, yeah. But a stream winner who's won is ditti sampanno. Someone who is sampanno means who endowed, who's got ditti. That's the stream winner. Is it the same in Sinhalese?
No, in Sri Lanka, it is say ditti is someone who has a kind of a bad spirit, so this is he has a ditti.
Okay. So it's really weird just how when the Pali language has gone into the vernacular, now sometimes the meaning is completely changed the other way around. But anyway, one of right view, it's very clear this is right view, but if you read the sutras a lot, this actually means a stream winner. So he said, what is a stream winner, is this actually saying? "Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the monks will remember it." So that's if you see a monk and you want to ask him a question, or the monk comes up to you and says, "I will teach you about something." You say, "Indeed, Ajahn, we would come from far away to learn from the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from you, the monks will remember it, or the Anagas will remember it." So that's just a polite way in those days of saying it. "Then, friends, listen and take closer to what I shall say. Yes, friend," the monks replied, "the Venerable Sariputta said this." So this is what's right view. "When, friends, a noble disciple understands the unwholesome," that's akusala, "and the root, the cause of the akusala, and the wholesome, the kusala, and the root of the kusala, in that way they are one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma." Now the idea of like wholesome and unwholesome, sometimes that's, to me that was always a bit too sort of Christian and Puritan. So I usually prefer the word like skillful. And skillful means it's an action of body, an action of speech, or an action of the mind which is going to produce the goal in mind, which is going to help you in the aspiration, whatever the aspiration is going to be. So like a skillful cook, you know, if you're working in the kitchen, doing breakfast or doing lunch, you see it's skillful, you actually know how to arrange everything and do things in such a way that produces the good results. So sometimes the skillful, it depends upon what the goal is. You know, if you say a skillful like cricket player, that's very different than being a skillful in the Dhamma. So this is like skillful in terms of the Dhamma. So what's the skillful which will actually produce the goal which you're after, and the root of the skillful, the unskillful, and the root of the unskillful. So what, so I'm going to use the word skillful for kusala. And what friends is the skillful? What is the root of the skillful? So what is the unskillful, the root of the unskillful, the skillful and the root of the skillful? Killing living beings is unskillful. Taking what is not given is unskillful. Misconduct in sensual pleasures, this is kamesu micchachara, the third precept, is unskillful. False speech is unskillful. Malicious speech is unskillful. Harsh speech is unskillful. Gossip is unskillful. Covetousness is unskillful. Ill will is unskillful. And wrong view is unskillful. This is called unskillful. Now you see from here, this is the ten akusala kamapata, the akusala, the unskillful dhammas. It's very well known in Pali, the first time it comes up here. And you can see we've got the first four precepts here, which we've gone through on the precept days, so I won't mention them. And after the fourth precept, you see that what's missing here is the fifth precept, which is drinking. So many people have said, well, it's not there, so obviously drinking alcohol is not unskillful. And taking cocaine is not in there. So taking cocaine is not unskillful. So what's your answer to that? Is it in the ten unskillful roots?
Wrong view.
Wrong view? Well, it's not really, it's the taking it is maybe not wrong view. I always put it into the covetousness, because this is like the greed, like looking for sensory desire. I always put it in there. But anyway, false speech is the lie, the fourth precepts, malicious speech. That's really, that word should really be called malicious gossip. And what that word means is you hear somebody say one thing, and you hear what they say, you may sort of say, well, say, oh, just, Buddha Rakata makes terrible apple crumble. Say, now hear him say, he doesn't like apple crumble, somebody. And then I go and tell you to split the two of you up. To say, you should hear what Wall is telling you about your apple crumble. And I do that for the malicious reason to create disharmony amongst you. Or you may be having an argument with Kim. And sort of I say something which supports Kim. Whatever is there to support disharmony within the group, by taking what you've heard and using that as ammunition to create more disharmony, to speak people up. That is the specific meaning of so-called malicious speech. And they say the opposite there is someone who loves harmony, who creates harmony with their words and with their actions. So it's a particular type of speech which maliciously creates disharmony in a group or society. And it's not done out of malice. If you pass on sort of what you've seen, not out of malice, because you know you think that somebody needs to be sort of told, you maybe see someone sneaking into the kitchen in the afternoon to feed themselves, you think, well, I better tell Ajahn Brahm because they're indulging in their defilements. I really want them to do better in this monastery. If you've got good motives, then that's not malicious. So this is malicious gossip, telling tales with malicious intent. That's what that particular means. And the harsh speech is just the sort of speech which calls people stupid names. You know, you stupid camel. Or, you know, you just You need to speak like a pig. People will be able to go to eat like pigs. Now that's harsh speech. Now giving people names, putting them down, diminishing them, or very violent speech. That's what it means by the harsh speech. And the opposite, they say, is like gentle speech, which is pleasing to the ear, soft and gentle, which goes to the heart. That's its opposite. So that's the harsh speech. And the so-called gossip here, I really don't like that the word gossip, because really the gossip is really a malicious gossip. This is much better described as useless speech. In other words, speech without a purpose, which hasn't got sort of any real benefit to anybody. And that is called the so-called sampapalapa, which is the speech which isn't useful. And you talk about sort of sport, you talk about clothes, you talk about sort of politics, you talk about things which has no real benefit for you. And you've got the next three things. You notice these aren't actions of body or speech. The last three are actually defilements of the mind, which is really strange to actually find them here. And covetousness, abhijja, the feminists say is a simile for kamachandra, it's another sort of desire. And ill will, you all know what that is, and wrong view. We say wrong view is not understanding this. And what is the root, the cause of the unskillful? And it's the three, what we call the kalesas, greed, hatred and delusion. So it's almost the root is the last three of these things. That's why the last three are there, because they're the sort of the mental cause for all these other departments. Greed, hatred and delusion. And what is the wholesome, in other words the skillful, and from killing living beings? Abstention from taking what is not given. Abstention from misconduct in sexual pleasures, which is usually adultery. Abstention from false speech, abstention from malicious speech, abstention from harsh speech, abstention from gossip, uncovetousness, non-ill will, and right view is skillful. This is called skillful. So in other words, as long as you're like in a coma, then you're always practicing the skillful. Is that correct? You're abstaining from everything. When it says in Pali abstention from things, it really doesn't mean just not doing that bad thing. It also means doing the opposite. So really, when it says abstention from killing living beings is skillful, what it also means is like looking out for living beings, caring for them, being compassionate for their welfare. And so abstention from taking what is not given is actually just living simple, being content with what you've got, and even being generous. And misconduct in sexual pleasures, and this is again for the lay person, for misconduct in sexual pleasures is making sure that you just stick with your one partner. If you're in 8 precepts, novices, monks, after having no sexual partner. And false speech is not just not speaking at all, but actually just being honest and trustworthy, so what you say is actually true. And instead of malicious speech, it's if there is any arguments or any factions, you are one who talks to people and just say, well, you know, just put a racket as apple crumble, it's very, very nice. You just put so much effort into doing that. So your speech, which actually tries to build people up and solve disharmony rather than just keep it going. So you're somebody whose speech creates harmony. And obviously harsh speech, your speech is gentle. People like to listen to you because you're very kind and praising. And the gossip is when you do talk, it is talk which people like to listen to. They often say when people talk too much, like anything else, like dirt, there's so much of it around, it's dirt cheap. But things like gold or diamonds, they're so rare, they have a high value. So people who speak a lot, their words aren't really valued. People who speak a little, then their words do become more important. And there's one great saying of the Buddha, it's the small little streams make all the noise. You go past that stream running down from the dam after the rain, it makes an enormous amount of noise in this monastery. You go by, say, the great river Swan, passing through Perth, it doesn't make any noise at all. It's the small streams make all the noise. Great rivers grow to heaven. So you ask yourself, am I a great river or a small stream? So we have just speak when it's necessary. And obviously covetousness, ill, it is almost like being had in delusion. So that is the root of the unwholesome. And what is the wholesome, as we've said, what is the root of the unwholesome, is non-greed, non-hate, and non-illusion. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the skillful and the root of the unskillful, the skillful and the root of the skillful, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, extirpates, which is another word for abolish, the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of suffering. In this way too, a noble disciple is one of the right view, whose view is straight, whose this unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at the true Dhamma. So basically, notice what's skillful for making the goal of enlightenment happen. So it is your precepts, they are skillful, they are important. You can't just imagine you can get anywhere just doing whatever you want, thinking you're just going to be mindful or you're just being detached. And also in these things you have the most importantly the covetousness, ill will and wrong view. So when you've understood these things, you entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, aversion and to the view of conceit, I am. And that's the personality view. So as soon as you get rid of that, you abandon the ignorance and delusion that you are somebody or you're in control, and arouse true knowledge, and you here and now make an end of suffering. So become arahant. So that's one way of understanding what right view is. Skillful, the path which leads to enlightenment here, put in a different way, sila, samadhi, and panya. Samadhi coming from overcoming the covetousness and will, and panya from wrong view being abandoned. And that's one way of describing what right view is. Any questions about that? Okay, say, good friend. Good friend. The monks delight and rejoice in the venerable disciple as well. They ask him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and is arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When says a noble disciple understands nutriment, this is the word ahara. In many of the Southeast Asian language, that's actually the word for food. In Thai it's ahan. What's it in Burmese? Food. Is similar? What do you think? Ahara, yeah. So you can see it's the food, things which actually sustain something. So, nutriment. When a friend and noble disciple understands nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, in that way they have one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So you can see here we have the first time the framework which we met for the Four Noble Truths. What a thing is, its cause, its ending or cessation, and the way leading to the cessation. So what does it mean by nutriment here? What is its origin, cessation, and the way into cessation? There are these four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be, and for the support of those about to come to be. So straight away here we can see that the Buddha was talking about reincarnation. Beings about to come to be. What for? They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. And that's very, I love that teaching, because these are the four nutriments which support a being who's about to come into existence, or especially beings who are in existence. So you need physical food to survive, but you also need contact is the second. In other words, what contact is, this is a special word for sensory experience, sense contact. And this is especially important if ever you have a relation who's, say, in a coma, and their sense contact is limited. That's why, whether you're a doctor or whatever, or just a friend or a relation, you talk to them. You touch them, you stroke them, you supply that that sense contact to them, and that often will keep them alive. Without the sense contact, they just drift off and just, they've got no support there. No support for life. So the sensory contact is actually one of the things which keeps people going. Now often, because of this, and because we know how the mind works, if somebody was like deaf and dumb and blind, and also they couldn't feel the body, they would just die. Without sensory contact, there's nothing to keep the life going. So that's why it's called a nutriment. It's as important as food. And what else is there? Is volition, mental volition, will. We all know the cases where somebody just give up the will to live, and they just die. And sometimes there's nothing wrong with them, they just decide they don't want to live anymore. So that will to keep going, so again it keeps one alive. And we just got a note from Venerable Sarana the other day. I was from Venerable Sarana, who was it? Somebody went to see Bhutan Mahabur, and it's 96.
Richard, his
96th birthday or whatever. And there's this really ancient monk, 96, and he's still going, and it's very clear that, you know, his mental volition is incredibly strong. And because of that, that's what keeps him going. So if he gave up that will, he could just die any old time if he decided to. And just like the Buddha, you know, he decided to give up the will to live at the chapel of the shrine, and 3 months later he just passed away into Parinibbana. So the mental volition, wanting to live, is also the third part of a nutriment which supports beings who have lived and will support beings who come into existence or come into a birth. And lastly is consciousness as the fourth, the ability to know. So knowing, doing, sense experience and food are the four nutriments. Now you can actually sometimes understand why it is that, you know, our teeth will let go of the knower, let go of the doer, and then you cease. There's no support left for either. But when you die, obviously they don't need any food anymore. You still have contact through the mind door and usually the mind-made body. So those last two are the most important. Consciousness and will keep the samsara rolling around. That's nutriment. Now, that's what they are. With the arising craving of tanha, there's the arising of nutriment. This is what causes them. Craving, wanting, causes obviously to have food, to eat, and also causes contact to happen, causes volition, and causes consciousness. With the cessation of craving, there is a cessation of these nutriments. Not interested in food, not interested in any contact anymore, so you're not going out there to look at sights or to hear sounds, to go and see Niagara Falls or to go and see Paris in the springtime or whatever people spend their money doing. So you're not looking for contact of experience anymore. So craving stops that way. And even lack of craving means the end of mental volition. It ceases. And also consciousness ceasing. With the cessation of craving, there's a cessation of these nutrients. There's a cessation of food, the cessation of contact, no more sensory experience, cessation of volition, no more will, the cessation of consciousness. Now what is the way leading to the cessation of nutriment? Guess what? The Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. So when a noble disciple thus understood nutriment, and what keeps beings going, the origin, the cessation, the way it is, the cessation of nutriment, you entirely abandon the underlying tendency to greed, aversion, and the view and conceit I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arising true knowledge, you here and now make an end of suffering. And that way too, another disciple is one of right view. His view is straight, his unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and the rider is true Dhamma. The rituals keep people going. Now, Four Noble Truths. Here we go. It's interesting they put this here after nutriment, then the Four Noble Truths. Saying, good friends, amongst the light of them, rejoicing the Venerable Sahib Buddha's words, then they ask him a further question. But, friend, might there be another way in which the Noble Sahib is one of right view and as well as this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When friends, the Noble Sahib understands suffering. Dukkha. The origin, cessation, the way of cessation of suffering. In that way, they're one of right view and as well as this true Dhamma. And this is the usual way that people talk about one who's got right view. Someone who's understood the Four Noble Truths is usually called a Sthivana. But the point is, people say, yeah, I understand the Four Noble Truths, and many people can recite it in Pali. But, are you a Sthivana yet? Which means you know how to recite it, but you don't really understand it. And that was really amazing to discover that, and to get your head around that. What is it I don't understand about these Four Noble Truths? So have a look at them again. So, saying, good friends, it might be when a friend, a noble disciple, understands the Four Noble Truths, and that way they have one of right views about this true Dhamma. And what is dukkha? What is the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way it leads to cessation of dukkha? Birth is suffering. And when you get your head around that, wow, it means you've already stuffed up. You've got born. So you and me are going to suffer. So when you go and blame somebody else for not turning up in the kitchen, not helping out, someone else for sort of the water running out, somebody else for giving you a hard time, it's nothing to do with them. It's your fault because you went and got born. That's what happens when people get born. You suffer. So you're stuck in this lifetime. So the problem is not trying to avoid suffering in this life so much, it's just too late, but making sure you don't get born again. Birth is suffering, so it's inherent in this existence that you're going to suffer. You're going to be out of control, things don't go your way, you're going to get frustrated, people are going to let you down, your mind is going to let you down. Your body is going to let you down. Life is going to let you down. Because that's what this life is. It sucks. That's what it is, suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. And few of you know that. But you're going to know it even more soon. Because it's more and more clear. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. And death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to say what you want is suffering. How many of you got what you wanted today? How many of you did get what you wanted? It's always going to happen, isn't it? Sometimes you don't get what you want, you blame somebody else, or you blame yourself. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I shouldn't have done that. It's nothing to do with you. It's part of life, it's not getting what you want. If you do get what you want, again, it sucks. Because it disappoints you. All craving is unfaithful. In other words, it promises you happiness. As soon as you get it, it's not happiness, you want something more. It's like finally, like the man finally finding the girl of his dreams. He marries her, and then he wants a mistress. Or people say, all I want in life is just, you know, my health. That's all I want in life, to have healthy again. And as soon as you get health, you want something else. I could only just win the lottery, just win the lottery, just once. And everyone who wins the lottery, they always buy another ticket next week. There's no end to that. So because of that, even if you get what you want, you're suffering. That's why you must say, it was Oscar Wilde who said, there's only two tragedies in life. The first is not getting what you want. That's the first suffering in life. The second suffering in life is getting what you want. And because of that, somebody told me once, there was an Arab curse. Some of the Muslims were really sharp, must be the Sufis. One of the worst curses they would give you in the Middle East. May you get everything you want. Immediately, as soon as you want it, may you get whatever you want immediately. Now it's a curse. And when you get your head around that, you say, wow, it's one of the worst curses. That'll drive a person crazy. So a lot of people, their life is all about hope, striving. It's that gap between wanting something and their aspiration to get it. And if you get everything you want immediately, you go crazy. That is called spiritual materialism. So that's, you know, a lot of people get lost in that. And you can see just how many people, they're just striving so hard to be someone. I know I've been this way, and some people sort of, you know, that it's almost like as soon as they made their material prosperity, they got a nice home, a nice family, and then they got their degrees, then they try and get the streaming or a sober partner and Sakata Gami, and they become like just like going to another university and getting more degrees. It's just, you know, more sort of the stripes on their shirt. It's total spiritual materialism. When meditating to let go, not to get things. So if you try to attain things with that type of craving, you'll turn against your aspirations and it will let you down. You get terribly disappointed. It's not the way. The Buddha tried for 6 years of a Bodhisattva. It was one of his mistakes, was trying so hard. He didn't realize the way to go is to let go. Not to try and attain, but to try and let go. Unfortunately, too much of that craving comes from the sense of self. So not getting what you want is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. That is called suffering. That's a great translation, because sometimes people said, oh, it's just attachment to the five khandhas of suffering. And as long as you don't attach to them, then you're okay. Now the Buddha said the khandhas themselves are suffering. So what are the five khandhas, the five aggregates? What's the first khandha? Body and things, rupa, that's material things. The second khandha? Vedana. What's Vedana?
Like and dislike and neither like nor dislike.
So that's the mental Vedana. This is any pleasure or pain concerned with any of the six senses. So in Pali they have this one word which covers all of that. In English we have a different word for every sense. So we've got like the sense of sight, we've got beauty and ugliness, and also between. It's that quality which makes it beautiful or ugly to the sight is called Vedana. And that same sort of assessment which makes a sound sonorous or grating, which makes a smell fragrant or stinky, which makes a flavour delicious or say bitter, which makes a physical feeling sort of pleasurable or painful, or makes a mental idea sort of delightful, pleasant or unpleasant. That sort of quality which defines the attractiveness or repulsiveness of any of these sense contacts is called Vedana. That's the second khandha. And the third khandha is? Aggregate? Sanya. Sanya, perception, yeah. And perception is when the mind gives things like labels. Boy, girl, monk, nun, sotapanna, putujana, sanyas, perceptions. And 2 weeks' time we'll be talking about perceptions and how they are bent by avijja, and that's the heart of the first sutta, Mula Pariyaya, to come up in 2 weeks. It's very subtle, as we want to leave it to the last. And that's perception. And the next one, fourth aggregate? What does that mean, mental formation, sankhara? Thoughts, that's one of them.
Emotional feelings.
Anything else under sankhara? The will, yes, that's the most important one, according to the Buddha. The will, Chaitanya, volition. That's part of sankhara. If you see what they call formations, because actually they build things. Your thoughts actually build up your world. Especially will, that's the creator. And what was the other one? Emotions are also very creative. So it's the creative part of that mind, the doing mind. And lastly, the fifth kanda. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
Mm-hmm.
Is that all? Remember, there's six types of consciousness. But sometimes in English, when we say consciousness, people think it's mind consciousness. This means sight consciousness, sound consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. And the Buddha notes here there's six completely separate animals. Six, this is consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. So what lies outside the five aggregates? The five candidates. Is there anything outside of that? But is that really outside of it? Because this is why the reason why the Buddha called the five aggregates, because it just takes in everything. It's only the absence of five aggregates that call nibbana, but not something which exists outside of it. Anyway, that's suffering, aggregates. Now if you look at that, like all form having a body is suffering. But also Vedana is suffering. Not just unpleasant Vedana, beauty is suffering. Sonorous sounds, delicious foods, pleasurable ecstasy in your body, having sex or having these drugs. Aha! Wonderful question. How that is suffering is because it's an affliction. Once it's disappeared, it's so free. It's like a person in jail. They've been in jail, born in jail, lived all their life in jail, you get used to it. Being in jail is suffering. It's nice in here. Getting a nice bed to stay in, 3 meals a day. But then one day you get released and think, geez, so much freedom outside. Just I never knew there was something apart from this experience which I thought was happiness. I remember some people, a person who was, I think they were born with like a headache and had it all their life, and then one day they got the headache relieved. And it was bliss. They'd never known for the moment without this ache. And now they found some cause, it was the neck was misaligned, some bone problem, and now it's free. Ah, so good. Or as Ajahn Chah used to say, that the person who's born with a rope tied around their neck, pulled tight by two demons. Now one day the two demons let go, and you can breathe. You're free from the senses.
How do you imagine it as well?
That's why you do meditation. Experience it, yeah.
If the disconnection is suffering, if the new connection is suffering,
yes,
it's not suffering.
Okay, so what happens is you get rid of the gross suffering, you get the more refined suffering. So you get out of these five senses and you go to the realm of the jhanas, the mind. And that's bliss. That's why I call it the bliss better than sex. And I say that for a good reason. To get people more interested in meditation. The bliss better than sex. And, you know my experience, I've got on record as saying that the first time that happens to me, because the first time I went into deep meditation, I was a student. I had a girlfriend, I was sleeping with her. And I just actually left her in Gloucester, I think, and just went off to this retreat. And a few days later, I got into deep meditation. So, both experiences were fresh in my mind. And it was just, it was a no contest. Just, the meditation was far, far more pleasurable, delightful, longer lasting than sexual orgasm. And that blew my mind. So, just why hasn't anyone told me about this before? Now, and afterwards, you reflect on this. Why? What's going on? And through experience, you realize the reason why that's pleasurable is because these five senses have gone. And just even the most best part of the five senses is just nowhere near. It's just this irritation which we take to be pleasure.
That's just the best part of that lot.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And once you get rid of the whole lot, wow, so nice. So that you've still got the mental pleasure. But then actually, that's why we've got many jhanas. You go through these jhanas. And then, when you get into a second jhana, this first jhana sucks. And then that starts really blowing your mind again. So the most pleasurable experience you can imagine is ecstasy, which is amazing. And then, from the viewpoint of a second jhana, that's suffering. So you realize as you go through the jhanas, you get to more and more refined happinesses. And really understanding what happiness is, and all that happiness is the end of some suffering. And that's why you end all of the consciousness.
And then, does it happen to you to suffer because you're not in the hour?
If, only if you want to get into the hour, that's where the suffering is.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a wanting. When you're in, not in jhana, of course you're suffering. It's just the suffering of existence. So this is actually where you realize what the suffering truly is. Now you can understand why some people, they can chant the Four Noble Truths, but don't understand it. And you can't sort of grasp the extent of suffering. Sometimes you mention this to people, that's why that sometimes the talks which I give, I say, only give it out to people who are practicing, don't give it out to everybody. They just won't understand it. Now when I say the effects of suffering, people say, oh, these monks are really weird. And you go and see a sort of therapist, and sort of get it out, and just afraid of relationships or whatever. And so sometimes, you know, you have to be careful who you talk to us about, because people just don't understand it. But this is it, this is the suffering of sensory experience. This is how this is one reason why people stay in monasteries. In this monastery, your sensory experience is totally limited, mostly curtailed. So why do you come here? There's some sort of peacefulness about not having to have sex or watch TV or, you know, watch music and all these other sensory enjoyments which run the world. People enjoy the joy of simplicity. What is simplicity? Only a calming down of the sensory world. You just take that further and further. Get more and more happiness. The sensory world is just so complicated. When you get into music, sex, sort of the joys of possessing things, it gets incredibly sort of entangling. That's why, you know, you and you just, you know, live in a car. You just have a few possessions. Why do you do that? It's much more fun. People think you're crazy. But from your situation, those guys are crazy in the big houses with the big families. And I'm on your side. Well, that's the suffering is the five aggregates. So what is the origin of suffering? Where the heck does it come from? It is craving, which brings renewal of being. Which brings reincarnation. That's what renewal of being is. That craving which gets you reborn again. That's a course. Which is accompanied by delight and lust. And delights in this and that. There's no end of things to delight in. That is, craving for sensual pleasures. That's actually for the five senses. Craving for being. This is the craving to exist. And this craving for non-being is the craving to annihilate yourself. These are called the origin of suffering, the three cravings. Now, note this is one thing which has been pointed out, I remember, by Vijnana Taloka. This is really weird, he didn't get it. He says, this is the craving for the five senses. What about the craving for mental pleasure? It's actually not in there. The Buddha knew that craving for mental pleasure, in a sense, that's going to lead you into jhanas and out of samsara. It's craving for five sense pleasures. But really, the craving for the jhanas, that is included in the craving to exist. In other words, to stop the jhanas and not to disappear totally. And any of you getting into deep meditation, that is one of the biggest hurdles. Every time you get into the deep meditation, you come across fear. The unwillingness to let go that little bit more, then it's because of the craving to be. Because if you go to the next step, you're disappearing. You are vanishing. In particular, your ability to control the world, your will, is disappearing. If you haven't done that before, that scares the shit out of you.
Is it the second jhana?
That's when it's full. When will finishes the second jhana. But even when you get into nimitta stages, and you talk with people getting into the deep meditations, they get so far they can't go further. Why is it? They get this fear, they just can't let go. Because what they're really letting go of is the idea of themselves. And that is that's the scariest thing you'd ever encounter. You disappear. It's me! I don't want to go. That's called the craving to be. And that's more powerful than the craving for sensory comfort. Which is why the people sometimes on their deathbed, their body is just a wreck and they're in total pain, but they will not let go and die. Because they think that when they die, they're just going to vanish. They'd rather be and suffer than not be at all. Which is a craving to be.
Yeah.
It's an enjoyable cup of tea, yeah, but you don't take that to be sort of the be all and end all of life.
But we're taking suffering to be the be all and end. You know, there is some good stuff.
What we're taking to be is to understand that when you're alive, you're going to have suffering. And you're going to. You've got this world of happiness and suffering, normal happiness and suffering, but it's underlying suffering. And a cup of tea is never quite sweet enough, it's never quite strong enough, it's never that perfect cup of tea. Almost, but not quite. You might have a beautiful relationship, it's never just quite right. You get a nice monastery, but it's not, there's always a few things which are wrong with it. And it's that sort of that flaw in the system. And sometimes people think it's just our mistake, that it's inherent to life.
Why is the system with a flaw? Why is there a system with this flaw in
it? Why is the system with a flaw in it? I think it's because it's inherent, sort of, in this nature. Basically, because the will always stir things up. And it's that stirring things up, that agitation, stops peace. If we did have perfection, we would mess it up. If you did move to paradise, you would pollute it.
So as long as there's will, there will be suffering.
That's right, yeah. No, Sartre said that suffering is other people, but it wasn't that, suffering was him. No, it's will. It's usually in empty terms for ill will. It's all will.
All will.
Will is the controller. But usually when you don't get your own way, that's called ill will.
It's just the condition trying to recondition itself.
That's right, yeah. He thinks it's going to get somewhere that way. Just try a little bit harder, Martin, and then you'll succeed. Just be a bit smarter. Yeah. And then you sort of get somewhere in life. And people have been teaching you that since you were a kid at school. Work harder, try harder, be a bit more wise in the way you sort of use your life. And in the end, you sort of suss it out. It just didn't get anywhere. It's just the same old problems, different forms, but same old problems. And after all, it's 26. So, will is a problem. You can't solve samsara by just refining your will. The will is a problem. And what is the cessation of suffering? It is a remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving which brings from your appeal. That is called cessation of suffering. Great. Remainderless fading away of that craving. Gone. Giving up, relinquishing, letting go, rejecting that same craving. That is called the cessation of suffering. Now you see, letting go, this beautiful word. But letting go of what? People let go of the wrong things. When it here says letting go of craving. And that's the most important thing. Letting go of the doer. So sometimes people only let go of their possessions, they come to a monastery. They let go of their wife, they let go of their husband, they let go of all their money and all their possessions, they come to a monastery. But they still suffer. And they come in here, okay, I'm going to let go of my thinking. And they try and sort of watch the breath, and they still don't get anywhere. Or they sort of, where else am I supposed to let go? I let go of all my comforts and just sleep on the floor. They don't get anywhere. So what's supposed to be there to go of is craving. Simply let go of the craving. The craving for five senses, the sense pleasures. Let go of the craving to be. Keep this. That's right, yeah, that'll do. So let everything go. And that's the way out.
Okay.
The thing is, the people, they let go of craving, and so their letting go becomes another form of craving. They crave to let go, rather than let go of craving. Come on, let go. Come on, let go. How many times do I have to tell you, let go? You can't do it. But this is a very skillful way when you learn just how to stop craving. Sit here, stupid mind. Fine with me. It's not my mind, none of my business. Restlessness, time, nothing to do with me. So don't pray for anything. Sorry?
Do you have to have a certain level of training to do
I think it's more like not really training, just enough guts, enough courage to go against. But the trouble is that the sense of self keeps on coming in. You don't want to disappear. It's most uncomfortable. You're not used to it. That's why the training just makes you used to letting go. More and more and more. And the most important part of the training is as you let go more and more, you get more and more peace, more and more happiness. So you get a payoff every level of letting go, you get another reward, which encourages you. This actually has they used to train the dolphins at the water park. It was like an incremental training. So they would jump up above the water, they get a fish. They jump up a little bit more, another sort of higher inch, they get a second fish. They jump a little bit more, then they get the next fish. So you know, you get your first fish, first jhana, that's the first fish, thank you very much. Second jhana, you get another fish. Another bit of happiness. That's how you train. Ah, yeah. Now that is the specific when, again, it's a very refined type of craving. That's when a person realizes that the five khandhas are suffering, birth is suffering. And so what they want to do, they want to end suffering. And they want to end suffering. It comes from a sense of self. So they're craving to annihilate existence. It's another form of craving. This is actually, sometimes you can see a form of that when you are meditating, you're trying to stop the mind. You're trying to do it, and you can't do it. You try to stop thinking. And can you stop thinking? If you try really hard, it's more thought. That's, you know, it's an old joke, but it's very apt about the four monks who had the vow of silence, and when one of them sneezed, you know that one. One of them sneezed, and the first monk said, bless you. The second monk says, you've broken your vow of silence. The third monk says, so have you. And the fourth monk said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. The idea behind that is, even if you do something, you know, you're speaking. When you try to stop something, you're creating more will. And this is what happens if you try and stop existence, the craving to be, so craving to annihilate existence creates more existence. Because you're exercising craving, more sense of I. Which is why that's not the way out. You've got the right idea, but the wrong way of doing it.
It's like
how you're
trying to
fix myself. That's right, yes. I remember reading Oliver Twist, Charles Dickens, and it was this man sort of had this idea, I think the guy led Oliver £5, and the friend said, I really distrust this young boy. He's not going to bring the £5 back. And he said, yeah, he's a good boy, he'll bring it back. And he said, if he brings it back, I'll eat my own head. that was actually just a way of saying things, to eat your own head. And then you contemplate, how can you eat your own head? You know, it's impossible to do. And it's exactly what the craving to of non-being is like, eating your own head. An eye trying to destroy the eye. So if you can figure out how to eat your own head, you can actually, craving for non-being can work. Yeah, it's like committing suicide. You get reborn afterwards. You've done something. You've created more existence.
He said about Ajahn Sumedho in one talk, that he said there is nothing wrong with killing yourself if you do it properly.
That's right, yeah. Well, this is actually what we're doing here. There's a suicide group, what it's called. Yeah.
What is the roadmap around the thinking?
Letting go of first thinking, being content, making peace, being kind, being gentle. Not trying to stop it, but stopping the cause of thinking, which is watching. Being discontent with the mind.
So that's the cessation of suffering. And what is the way of being the cessation of suffering?
Is that the question you just asked?
Dying forever.
Sorry?
Dying forever.
So what now, the way to do it is that noble eightfold path. Right, we are intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness and stillness. So in each one of these, it says eightfold path is the way to end all of this stuff. Yes. When the disciples thus understood suffering, dukkha, the origin of suffering, cessation of the cessation of suffering, then you are one of right view. Then you can be a stream, and you can see just how deep the Four Noble Truths actually are. Incredibly powerful teachings. And so many people know them, but they think they understand them and haven't really got into them enough. So in good friends, amongst the light and rejoicing, the venerable soul could as well. Then ask them a further question. Then we go into very cleverly interdependent origination. Well, there'll be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view who's arrived at true Dharma. There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death. In that way, they're one of right view, one is arrived at the true Dharma. So here we go into dependent origination. You know, from suffering, aging and death. What is aging and death? Its origin, cessation, or way leading to cessation. The aging of beings and their various orders of beings. Their old age, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair, wrinkling of skin, decline of life, weakness of faculties. This is called aging. So this is not some metaphorical aging, like a mind state sort of aging and disappearing. This is the aging of beings. This is why it's beautiful. It says quite clear: old age, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair. The passing of beings out of their various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates, laying down of the body. This is called death. So it's not that death of a moment. This is actually death. Go to an undertaker, or having to get buried if you're, or cremated, or animals dying, insects dying. This is death in its usual meaning. I know that sometimes people do interpret dependent origination in a more symbolic way. Like the death of an idea, the death of a mind state, the death happening at every moment. You're born every moment and it dies afterwards. That's fine, but what the Buddha meant here is death, 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 and aging, aging, aging. So the aging and death are what are called aging and death. So in other words, this aging and this death, combining them together is aging and death. With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. The cessation of birth is the cessation of aging and death. The way leading to the cessation of aging and death is just this noble eightfold path, this right view to right stillness. So I know that there are some people who read these New Age magazines. There's no reason why a human being should die. Now, if we just tweak the genetic code, we can live forever. And maybe, you're into biomedicine. Maybe, can you see a way in the future, humanity, of tweaking the genes so they can always replicate themselves and so they will never age and die? That people think that. I remember seeing this movie once, when I was a kid, of Dracula. This was supposed to be the thinking man's Dracula. Because this particular Dracula, he was immortal. And the only way he could die is either, not through the stake of the heart business, but if he was caught out in the sunshine, he could only come out at night. And if the rays of the sun fell on Dracula, then he would die. And in the end, this Dracula had been around for about 400, 500 years of living. And basically, he'd been there, done that. He was so pissed off with life, he basically allowed himself to be drawn out into the sunshine because he had enough. Eternal life was the biggest suffering for him. I always remember that. It was really so interesting. If people did want to live forever, that would be torture.
So the Christians
want
to live forever.
Yeah, they're crazy. It's got no sense at all. And I used to tell those sorts of jokes that, according to what I was told, when you go up to heaven, you wear these white clothes, eat ambrosia, and listen to harp music. Imagine about 3 centuries of having the same thing every morning for breakfast, ambrosia. If you stick to the teeth with ambrosia, give me something else. Anything. So eternity is suffering. Anyway, that's for you to look at. So, cessation of birth is a cessation of aging and death. So when you're born, you're going to get old, you're going to die. The Buddha is saying, there's no way out of that. You may sort of die early and don't go through the worst part of aging, but that's what's going to happen to us. Four elements, but they break down, well, that's called a death as well. Yes. But, we're all going to die. And that's the problem, one of the problems anyway. And what's the way in the cessation of aging and death is the Eightfold Path again. The noble disciples thus understood aging and death, its origin, the cessation, the way in the cessation of aging and death. They can now, here and now, make the end of suffering. And that way to a noble disciple is one of right views of this true Dharma. Saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable disciple of his words, they asked him a further question. But friends, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and is right of this true Dharma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands birth, the origin of birth, the cessation of birth, and the way it ends the cessation of birth, and that way they're one of right view. Okay, if we identify birth as a problem, when you're born you're going to suffer. Now, where does this birth come from? Why are we born and how can we stop being born? What is birth? Its origin, cessation, and waiting, the cessation of birth. The birth of beings in the various orders of beings. And actually, I got this one. Now, this is from the Mahanidana Sutta. Nidana means causality, so this is the dependent origination in the Digha Nikaya. And here they have all the different types of beings. The birth of any kind that is gods and the state of gods. Gandhavas into Gandhava state, yakas into yakas, the manusa, that's human beings into human beings, the four-footed into four-footed, that's the animals, the birds into birds, the creepy crawlies into the creepy crawlies, each into their own state if there are no birth of beings at any sort in any state. So this is actually all different types of beings. So the birth is the birth of beings in the various orders of beings, the coming to birth, precipitation into a womb, generation, manifestation of the aggregates, obtaining the basis for contact. This is called birth. Now with the arising of being here, now this being is called Bhava, I'll explain this in the next one. When this is Bhava, this existence, there is the arising of birth. With the cessation of Bhava, existence, there's a cessation of birth. And the way it is the cessation of birth is this Noble Eightfold Path. If you practice the Eightfold Path properly, it ends birth. When Noble Sahibs have understood birth, its origin, cessation, the way it is its cessation, they have one of right view and they can here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, to a Noble Sahib is one of right views of the true Dhamma. Saying, good friends amongst the light and rejoicing in the venerable Sahibs' words, then they ask even a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a Noble Sahib is one of right view and is right as true Dhamma? There might be friends. When a friend, a noble disciple, understands Bhava, I call it here being, but it's being in a very refined sense. The origin of being, the cessation of being, the way it is the cessation of being, in that way they're one of right view, is right and is true Dhamma. So what is being, its origin, cessation, the way it is the cessation? There are these three kinds of being, sense sphere being, bimaterial being, and immaterial being. So sense sphere being means all those planes of existence in the karma loka, that's the sense sphere, down from the hell realms, the ghost realms, the animal realms, the human realms, and the lower deva realms. Now I remember just talking with, I think actually with Bhikkhu Bodhi, he was actually in this, it's one of my inputs here. The Bhava as being or existence, because there's many quotes here, like Manasa Bhava is a state of human existence. So the being here is actually the levels of existence, the planes of existence, if you might try to call it that way. That's what this Bhava really means. So what it's really meaning, you have to have the planes of existence, a place to get reborn into, and then there can be rebirth. So this is basically the stations of consciousness, the places where you can get reborn into. That's what Bhava means. And here they're just to the three types. The sense sphere, the fine material being, which is the jhana realms, and the immaterial is the arupa realms. Now with the arising of craving, there's the arising of this state of being. Cessation of craving. Clinging here. Clinging is upadana. Sometimes called clinging, the other meaning of upadana is fuel. So clinging, fuel, the fuel for existence. There's the arriving of these stages of states of existence. So the cessation of clinging or fuel, there's a cessation of being. And the wedding, the cessation of being, is just this Noble Eightfold Path of this right view into right stillness. And no disciples thus understood this being, Bhava, its origin, cessation, where it leads to its cessation, they here and now make an end of suffering, and that way to a noble disciple's one of right view and right of his true Dhamma. How many planes of existence are there? Is that all? Can we have 32? Yeah, the karma makes them all. There's no reason why there can't be more now. These are not fixed. For example, you've got the realm of the 33. The Tower Kings are devas. What happens when one of those Tower Kings are devas, because of the exhaustion of the karma which led to that rebirth, passes away? Is that now the realm of the 32? Was there a realm of the 33 before those 33 rose up there? Or did those 33 create that one?
Which is the matter? Is it inherent in the structure? Or is it created by mind?
Exactly. It's not inherent in the structure. So these Bhava, states of existence, is actually what we create. We create these worlds. Because, as many people pointed out, there are some other devas which actually don't fit in that plane of 31. One of them is the Kidda devas, the devas who delight in play. And, you know, people notice that. That's actually mentioned, I forget where it's mentioned in the suttas by the Buddha. And he said, where in the 31 planes are they? You know, they actually don't fit in there. So because of that, you can see these 31 planes of existence, but the jhana realms are pretty fixed, we can't do much about those. But these actual realms, which bhava means, you know, the upadana, from the fuel, the also the cravings coming before that, these actually create these realms. So the creative force of the human being, of the mind, sorry, is immense. We create these realms, we can create these hell realms. And these ghost realms. We make them as we basically think they should be. Probably is by now. Who knows the what's called perpetual proliferation. And these realms may be different levels of the realms. Just like you're talking Buddhism, there's only one Sangha. And how many Nikayas are there now? And they keep on spinning into new ones. Well, other people might still come and join you, especially if they're associate people who have been your friends. You've done karma together. Just like the realm of the 33, they've done karma together. It's good. So the karma is connected before they got reborn.
If I understand right, just in the karma book, the new
pretty much so, yeah. The higher ones are kind of pretty fixed, yeah, inherent, because they're inherent in a particular state of mind.
Yeah, there's a couple of places where the Buddha talks about wrong view, and that he only sees two possible destinations for rebirth. For example, with wrong view, which is either the hell realm or the heavenly realm. So, what kind of wrong view does he mean?
It must be pretty bad wrong view, and acting on that wrong view. He also says that sometimes people have wrong view and wrong actions that get reborn in heaven wrong. So, he made this wonderful simile. This has got a heavy end, it's got a heavy end here and a light end. So this is a heavy end, this is the light end. I'm going to throw it up, this end is going to hit the ground first. Okay. Always a heavy end. That's not always the case. Sometimes it lands on the light end. He said that's like a being with good karma, bad karma. If it's a heavy end, it's good karma, and the light is what it is, it's going to end up in good karma, going to be a good rebirth. You've got bad karma because you're in the wrong view. You've got lots of it. Sometimes you've got enough little good karma, but sometimes the stick lands on the right end. And sometimes it says that some of the really bad karma get good rebirth. Sometimes people with good karma get bad rebirth. It's similar to the stick. The likelihood is that if you have good karma, you get a good rebirth. The likelihood is you have bad karma, you get a bad rebirth. It's not fixed. But by making lots of good karma, you're increasing your chances. But even so, samsara is very uncertain. Which means the only way to get out. Making good karma is more fun. It does work, but you're just increasing your chances. But still, the stick is happening. It works. I thought, well, make a lot of good karma, not perfect, but making good karma, at least you can go to some sort of nice, get a good rebirth. Not always, because we've all made some little bit of bad karma here and there. And if that's the raw stick ends on that one, you're all stuffed. That's scary. I mean, that really was scary for me. So you better get spiritual with this. You know, not mess around, otherwise, who knows.
If you think of all of your lives, I mean, that life now is such a small amount anyway.
It is, yeah. It is. So, yeah, okay. You go to a bad destination, but eventually a good karma comes up and you get out. So it's not that. You know, obviously, good karma is a wonderful thing to do. The point was, it's not certain. That's why we said wrong view is only two destinations. Most of the time, but you have wrong view and get to heaven.
It's maybe just the people he talks to in this particular.
That's right, he said the likelihood is, yeah. Eventually you're going to end up down there if you carry on that.
Yeah. If you can't do straight away, I feel practice. Can you go to observe world and then practice here?
Yeah, so you've got to make sure that, you know, that one end is very heavy and the other one is very light.
Can you
take those little brackets that put in the mouth? Great question. The answer is yes. There are cases of that. Sometimes you see in the books there that the Buddha gave a sermon and many monks became a mind. Many demons were listening as well. They became a mind as well. There's a few cases about it. There's one with one of the lovely ones. There was, I think, Sopaka. She was a lay disciple, a woman. And these two monks, they came wandering around, and they came to this beautiful place just before the rains retreat. And it's by a river, very peaceful, very conducive for meditation. And they asked this lady, who was a devout Buddhist, can we stay here for the water? Oh, amazing! Look, now I'm a devout Buddhist, you just go there, I'll get my husband to build a couple of huts for you, and I will look after you. I'll get all the services for you, because I just want you to do the retreat for 3 months. So, you know, she gave them food, whatever they liked, even did their washing for them. And it's like, you know, when you go on a retreat for sort of, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, and all the other sort of valley guides to really help you out, and this was like a really first-class service. So this lady, you know, she washed for them, cooked for them, cleaned for them, so the monks had nothing to do for 3 months, just meditate. She was so happy to be able to do something like that, so people could actually get somewhere. And anyway, when she died, she got reborn in the it was in the Tawa Tingsa realm, and these men, she was wondering one day in the Tawa Tingsa realm, I wonder what happened to those 2 months I looked after. And then using her psychic power, she found them in the next level down, in the realm of the four great kings. It was like, you know, these lowly yakas or whatever. And she was really upset. You know, I spent 3 months slaving, cooking and cleaning for these scallywag monks, and she went down and blasted them. You know, and told her that, you know, you monks, I was, you know, really had a hard life, you know, and, you know, you had all this opportunity, meditating for 3 months, and what the heck did you do? You know, you're not even in the realm where I'm at. And one of the monks, you know, like being a man, just a woman, just didn't listen at all. And the other one, sort of, they established, sort of, they said, mindfulness. Now, mindfulness doesn't mean just, you know, satipatthana, it's also mindfulness means remembering the teachings. And at that, he had an enlightened experience of what we've gone in this, I think, in the Anagama was. So, you know, he did get a state of enlightenment. Basically, that, you know, you had all the means there, you just need to be lazy just to bang him on the head and sort of remind him. So, it does happen.
But it's very difficult because there is not a lot of suffering around this, right?
It's not, but now and again, but they come and listen to someone giving a talk. I was already in the talk, well, in that particular case, one of the day was just scolded them.
But it's not nice, something which is not nice, but which kind of makes you strive in that direction.
Indeed, it's possible, but it's more unlikely. You do need something, some stimulus from outside of that realm, basically.
But can those beings get angry or things like that?
Oh, yeah, they get angry. But should they get angry, the last time they disappear from that rock. Okay, there's a stage of existence, of being. It all comes around from this fuel. So what is this fuel, this clinging, this upadana? Sometimes they call it attachment. Attachment has sort of this meaning in Pali, like a fuel, like it's the what's it called, like the oil. Gives rise to the flame. Now the oil is the fuel, and they say almost like the flame attaches to the fuel. It's sort of the fuel is the source of the flame, and this is upadana, is like the fuel for being. So saying good friends, the monks delighting and rejoicing in the side of Buddha's world, they ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which an open side is one about you, and this one is true down, there might be friends, but friends, an open side understands fuel, I'm going to call it. Attachment, clinging, these are the three translations of this term, upadana. And if it means upa, means up, and adana, as in adinadana, where adana is taking. And if it means taking up, That's its literal meaning, taking up. Like the flame takes up the fuel. Like clinging is taking up things. Yeah. I'm now clung to this, I've taken it up. That's what this clinging actually means with the Dhamma. So, another way. When a friend, a noble disciple, understands her taking up, the origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of taking up, and that way they're one of right view, one is the right of this true Dhamma. What is taking up, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation? There are these four kinds of taking up, four types of fuel or clinging. The fuel of sensual pleasures, the fuel of views, the fuel of rules and observances, and the fuel of the doctrine of the self. Now the first of those upadanas, or fuels, attachment and clinging if you like, is to sensory enjoyment, the five senses again. And again, it specifically does not mean the six senses of the mind. So the attachment is very clear in the Pali, it's karma upadana, the K long A-M-A. Then karma loka. The karma is always of five senses. So the clinging to the mind is not meant to be, it's not a fuel which gives rise to renewed existence. So this is the clinging to the five senses, and these last three are all clinging to ideas or views. The clinging to the views, and again this is the ditti in the sense of the wrong views. Clinging to rules and observances, it rules is sila, and observances is vata, or your duties. And that has confused many people, it is explained very clearly by the Buddha. This means the clinging, the fuel of just keeping precepts, being pure is all you need to do. It's almost like the Puritan idea. As long as you know you're a good person, and then you just go to heaven, that's all you need to do. And the vata, they had the two extreme vatas, the cow vata and the dog vata, mentioned in the Digha Nikaya. And that's when these two men went to see the Buddha, and one was on all fours like a cow and hung out with the cows and ate grass, and the other one was also on all fours and hung out with the dogs and ate dog food. And no, in India they've still got some people like that these days. And they thought that this was like an ascetic practice, and it's such a hard thing to do, that, you know, if you do something like this, you've renounced all your pleasures by, you know, living with the dog and curling up with the dogs at night time, that you must become enlightened. You're obviously someone really special. So they came up to the Buddha one day, probably the cow man just mooing and the dog ascetic barking, and they asked the Buddha, said, we've been doing this for a long time, it's so difficult, what's going to be our destination? You know, are we going to become enlightened? And that's when the Buddha said, don't ask me that. But they asked him and said, okay, well the cow said that you're going to be reborn as a cow and you're going to be born as a dog. And I think, well, so the dog said it started crying. And then the cow said it didn't believe him, just went away mooing. And the dog said it just realized he'd done all this really hard work for such a long time. It wasn't going to get him anywhere. And you imagine just, I was actually quite touched by that. Poor guy, he'd done so much hard work, so much effort, and endured so much, and it's for nothing. So that's actually the what it says, the idea of those sorts of duties by itself is not enough. And lastly, the fuel of a doctrine of the self, of me, mine, the self, that I am the will, I am the consciousness. That is the fuel, the most important of all, which gets you into a new existence. Because you are, you want a place to be. And because you have a place to be, then you have birth. And a whole more suffering. And it's the clinging to the doctrine of self, that's the root one.
So it's basically the three pleasures? Or at least two of them are in there?
Two of them in there, yeah, they are indeed, yes. But the upadana or sensual desire, that's in the fourth letter.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned about not having the mental creator, but what if the creator is good and worthy and meant to delight?
Okay, well that is a craving which is part of karma dhamma. It's craving for sensory pleasure, craving for the five sense world. That is the fuel of karma padana. So if your mental cravings are for physical things, or sounds, smells, tastes, touches, that's karma padana. But if they're the craving, or this particular upadana, the delights of the jhanas, or the inspiration of listening to a good dhamma talk, those are things you delight in, that's not included in the Supadana. So if you really enjoy and get off on, say, reading the suttas, that's not a fuel which will give rise to rebirth. That's a fuel which ends rebirth.
That's
all right
about delighting and wanting to do good things
It depends why you're doing the dharma. It depends why you are doing the dharma. Your intention behind or your goal. If it is, instead of to support the people doing it, to let go of one's own attachments and cravings, that's far more noble. So we're giving dharma as part of our own practice of abandoning our attachments. And for the inspiration you get from maybe seeing good monks, good lay people practicing. And for that inspiration, which is a mental happiness, that you can get sort of deeper meditation and great wisdom. So that's why you give dharma, because you know that some people give dharma. They're not quite sure what they're doing it for, just because their mum did it or their grandma did it. They haven't really got much clue. It's still good, but it's not the sort of action which will end suffering or just give them heavenly rebirth. So when a noble disciple is thus waiting for the end of clinging or fuel, again it's another eightfold path. So when a noble disciple has understood clinging, its origin, cessation, or when interest is cessation, they hear not make any suffering. This way, the noble disciple is one of our views of the true dhamma. So now we've got craving. This is the dhamma. It's also meant like thirst, which is another meaning of it. And that gives it this understanding what it really is. Craving, when you're really thirsty, you just really need sort of a cup of tea. I need some water. And it's just this move, you have to get this. I'm craving for it. Saying, good friend, the bhikkhus have asked to rejoice in the venerable disciple just were to ask him a further question. May there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of our views about this true dhamma? There might be things when fed a noble disciple understands dhamma, craving. The origin, cessation, where it is cessation of craving. In that way they are one of our views about this true dhamma. Now what is craving? Its origin, cessation, where it is cessation of craving. It's in the Four Noble Truths they gave the three different types of craving. Do you remember them? Yes, that's right, yeah. But here they give a different definition. The six classes of craving. Craving for forms, for sounds, for odours, for flavours, for tangibles, and craving for mind objects. These are the objects of the six senses. This is just another way. It's not different, it's just putting them in a different sort of categorisation. So with the arising of vedana, there is the arising of craving. Like the pleasure or pain, or beauty and suffering, which is part and parcel of the sensory experience. So with the arising of the vedana, there's arising of this craving. With the cessation of vedana, there's a cessation of craving. The way in the cessation of craving is just another eightfold path, that is right view up to right stillness. The noble disciple thus understood craving, origin, cessation, the way in cessation of craving, they hear now make an end of suffering, and that way two noble disciples what a right view, to the right of this true dhamma. So does that mean, it says here with the arising of vedana, there is the arising of craving. So what about the arahats? Do arahats have vedana? Do they experience pleasure and pain and beauty and happiness and delicious food and bitter food?
Did
they
have
any? Yeah, well, I didn't ask that, but do they have patient pain?
Yes. They don't have the reaction.
Well, it says here that they got Vedana, so therefore from the rising of Vedana is the rising of craving, the Buddha says here. So it means that, well, if arahats have Vedana, they must have craving, doesn't it say that?
No, they have broken through it, because there is no self.
They don't have will. It's broken at the will level, not at the Vedana.
Okay. Now, when we get to the breaking of it, it's always broken at avidya. So the point here is that when it is actually craving here, when there is Vedana and there is avidya, now no understanding, then there arises craving. So here it's not actually mentioned here. So sometimes when you have this causal factor here, yeah, you've got to have, without Vedana you can't have craving. But when there is Vedana, it's not always craving. So, but when there's Vedana, there's experience and there's delusion. You don't understand what beauty and ugliness are. You don't understand what pleasure and pain are. Then you have the craving. So I think I even said last Wednesday that all, this is one of the sayings I've often said, all pleasure is just a pause between two moments of suffering. And all dukkha is a pause between two moments of happiness. And when you understand it that way, you know, that's a good understanding. There's no craving anymore. With all this sort of, we crave to have, you know, more happiness, more pleasure, and we know that when you crave, you don't crave, you just get a fair share either way. Because when the pain disappears, then you have happiness. And look at the happiest times of your life. Why are they happy? Sometimes I notice that when you finish your exams at school, you know, you have schoolies week here over it, and kids go berserk. Why is that? Because all the pain of studying and the hard work is over. That's why it's happy. I remember being sick with a fever. When I came out of hospital, I never felt so fit and healthy. The reason was because I could recognize that health because of the sickness which had just passed. A lot of times, you notice when people are most happy when their team wins the competition. So all the suffering which went before. The more suffering has gone before, the more happiness it is now. Your team always wins. You know, people hardly ever get happy. They take it for granted. If your team's lost, and then they win the competition. Wow! It's ecstatic! Maybe for a couple of hours. It's the same when you fall in love and get married. And it's the happiest day of your life. Maybe you got married. How long does it last? It's all the suffering which goes before and all the suffering which comes afterwards. That makes it the happiest day. Very quick while you're ahead. When you start a relationship, have happiness, but it's not going to last. It can't last. You see, because all the happiness is this related condition by the suffering which went before. And all the suffering. So if you are in heaven having a beautiful time, and today the ambrosia is not as sweet as it was, you know, yesterday, that's suffering. You go bananas, you go berserk. That's why the people live. You know, the way we live today, if you compare it with 50 years ago, we live in mansions. The amount of food we have, the entertainment we have. You think, why would everyone have any suffering today? But we have as much suffering and happiness as people 100 years ago. Simply because maybe their happiness and suffering was sort of much, much lower down than us. But we still have the change. It's a change which causes the suffering. When pain disappears, we have the happiness. When happiness disappears, we have the suffering. It's impermanent, it changes. We've got no, can't control it. Wherever you are. So that is why Vedana, when it's not understanding it, it causes the craving. And with the cessation of Vedana, the cessation of craving, the cessation of, that's interesting, cessation of Vedana. Can you have cessation of Vedana? Means you're not experiencing anything. This is interesting. Let's see what happens afterwards. The way that it's a cessation of craving is just, it's no break for a path. The noble suffering has thus understood craving, its origin, cessation, the way leads to cessation, they hear no making end of suffering. That way too, a noble suffering is one of our views, rather than to a Dhamma. Good friend, the vicar's delighted to rejoice in the venerable sight of Buddha's words. They ask him a further question. But friend, might there be another way? There might be friends, he must be very patient. When friends on the other side of understands Vedana, its origin, cessation, and when into cessation of Vedana, they're one of right view. What is Vedana? Its origin, cessation, and when into cessation? Well, there are six classes of Vedana. Vedana for born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact, the six senses. With the arising of contact, this is the sensory world beginning to happen. When there's a sensory experience, there's contact, the senses are turned on, if you like, then it has to be a Vedana. It's either pleasurable, it's unpleasant, or it's somewhere in between. That's just the nature of Vedana. You like it, you don't like it, or it's somewhere in between. And even for arahats, it's the same. Vedana is Vedana is Vedana. Some of it is nice, some of it is unpleasant. And some of it's in between. So with the arising of contact, the arising of Vedana, with the cessation of contact, there's the cessation of feeling, waiting cessation of feeling as if there's no black hole path. No disciple understands this? Okay. And they go quickly through these ones and they're going to put them all together. Saying, good friend, the monk's delight and rejoicing in the venerable sight of his words, ask him again, it's another way. There might be friends, when friends and open disciple understands this contact, this is passive, its origin, cessation, waiting from cessation, they are one of the right view. What is contact, its origin, cessation, waiting from cessation? There are six classes of contact. Again, for the six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind contact. With the arising of the sixfold base, there's the arising of contact, the cessation of the sixfold base, is the sense basis. There's the cessation of contact, the way it is, the cessation of contact is this eightfold path. The sixfold base, good friends, is another way there is. When friends and noble disciple understands the sixfold base, its origin, cessation, where it is, the cessation, I'm abbreviating this now. They also one of our views about this true Dhamma. What is the sixfold base? Its origin, cessation, the way it enters the cessation. There are these six bases, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind base. With the arising of Nama Rupa, mentioned out of materiality, it's the arising of the sixfold base. Cessation of Nama Rupa is the cessation of the sixfold base. The way it enters the cessation of the sixfold base is his noble eightfold path. So, good friends amongst delighted and rejoiced in the venerable sight of Buddha's words, they ask him a further question, but then might there be another way? Yes. When friends and noble disciple understands Nama Rupa, mentality, materiality, its origin, cessation, way into cessation, they're one of right view. What is Nama Rupa? Its origin, cessation, way into cessation? I'm going to pause here, this is important. Nama Rupa. Feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. These are called mentality. The four great elements in the material form derived from the four great elements, these are called materiality. So this mentality plus this materiality are what's called mentality and materiality. This is important here because these you can see, Vedana, Sanya, Volition is the Sankara. These are the three aggregates, number 2, 3, 4. Consciousness is missing here. The point. The Abhidharma messes up the whole thing by putting consciousness in here under mentality. It's specifically accepted here. And four great elements, that's Rupa Khanda. So these are the four khandas. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's specifically excluding consciousness, because that's coming next. So that's Nama Rupa. Sometimes I call it the objects of consciousness. In other words, what comes together with consciousness, but you know, outside of consciousness. This is mentality and mutality. With the rising of consciousness, we get the Nama Rupa. With the cessation of consciousness, it's the cessation of Nama Rupa. The way leading to cessation of Nama Rupa is just this Eightfold Path, as before. Now, consciousness, and I'll bring these last few all together. So in good friends, mother, be another way, yes, there is. When friends, another sergeant understands vijnana, consciousness, its origin, cessation, waiting to the cessation. They are one who's arrived at right views about this true Tao. What is consciousness, its origin, cessation, awaiting to the cessation? The six classes of consciousness, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness, all separate types of consciousness. In the arising of sankhara, there's the arising of consciousness. Cessation of sankhara is cessation of consciousness. The waiting of cessation of consciousness is just this noble eightfold path that is right view to right stillness. When noble disciples thus understood consciousness, its origin, cessation, and waiting of cessation, they have right view and they can now make an end of suffering. Now, I went through those last ones very quickly because you have consciousness and nama rupa. Elsewhere, the Buddha talked about those two as being like two sheaves of reeds leaning against each other. Consciousness and, again, the nama rupa here, feeling, perception, volition, attention, and contact. So these two support one another. When one disappears, the other one goes. When we have the causality, these two actually just basically totally together. When one goes, the other one can't exist. So that's where they're codependent. Now I mention this because consciousness, if you are conscious, you have to have vedana, sanya, sankara. You can't be consciousness without having these things, in particular vedana. So if you are conscious, you're going to have pleasure and pain. There's no alternative. You can't have consciousness and only have pleasure. Nor can you have consciousness without vedana. They have to come together. So the idea of having some sort of cosmic consciousness, which is just conscious but never suffers, is an impossibility. So, but you've got consciousness and mentality and materiality. And part of that is, you know, to be conscious, you have to have the six bases. You have to have the contact, you have to have faith in that. So these five are actually contiguous. Consciousness, nama rupa, six sense bases, or one of them, contact and vedana, they all arise simultaneously. You can't have one without the other. So when you have causality, sometimes the causality is a time lapse. So, you know, you light a fire and maybe afterwards, you know, you get the heat which you can feel. You know, you do that in the lighting a fire down in the stove, it takes a few minutes for the heat to get up there, and so we can feel it up in the upper story. So sometimes a cause happens and then the result happens a long time later. But these words, consciousness, nama rupa, sixfold base, contact and feeling, these happen all together. Contiguous. Same time. That's why I went through them very quickly. But in particular, consciousness and nama rupa, they're the core ones. They happen together. That's why sometimes when some monks talk about original mind, I ask them, what's it conscious of? What type of vedana has it got? If it's conscious, it will suffer. But also here, you see this eightfold path, it leads to, it says here very quickly, very clearly, to the cessation of consciousness. To the cessation of vedana, that's the nama rupa, sorry, the cessation of sixfold bases, the cessation of all your senses, the cessation of contact, the cessation of vedana. It is the cessation of these things, in particular the cessation of consciousness. So actually, it's quite clear the Buddha is saying, if you practice the eightfold path, again, you said spiritual suicide. Your consciousness, bye-bye, is going to cease. Your vedana, bye-bye. Your volition, bye-bye. And saying goodbye to all of these things. The cessation, not just the cessation of craving and the cessation of attachment, but with that, going your very consciousness and your... Yes?
Yeah.
Does anybody hold the view of an original mind or that the arahat exists after death? Does it mean they can't be in the freelancer?
Yes. But when I say that, people go, uh oh, I'm in a bit of trouble. But I agree with you. That's controversial, let's move on.
About the Nama-Rupa business.
Yeah.
So feeling and perception, and then volition, contact and attention, those three go into the
Sankara.
Into the Sankara.
Yep. Yeah. And they're the main ones of the Sankara. Yeah. And that's actually Sariputta that he actually put those in, and this is, we often quote this, it's what Nama-Rupa is, or rather the Nama is. And yeah, he did this brilliant, and it's very clear. It's basically the second, third, and fourth canvas. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
And the sixfold base, I was just thinking about blind people, for example, they still have the base, but they don't have.
That's right, yeah.
But they don't have the organ and the contact.
That's right, yeah.
Which happens. But the base is there.
The base is there, but yeah.
What is it?
Well, sometimes you say the base is not working, so they can be reborn without the base.
Okay.
So basically, the essential organ is just shot.
But the base is not something you can kind of grasp and understand.
You know, it is just the basically organ of sight, not the eye, not the nose, but that's the sensory ability to have senses. And sometimes it's shot. Sometimes it's just not functioning, and some great doctor might come along and connect something up, and you can smell again, or you can see again, which sometimes happens. So there's like a sense base. Yeah. But it's true that sometimes there are people, beings with only five sense bases. And there are even some beings who've only got one sense base. These are the people in me. Yeah, just mind base, the other four bases of God. Especially in the immaterial, that's what we call arupa. Is that right? It is. One base, four canvas. And there are some beings who have got, this is the most weird one, which is the, what is it now? It's
mind what? Only, isn't it? And body only.
No, they've got just the body only. The Asanyasata.
Mm.
So that's got just one kanda, which is body, without waiting asanya, sankara, or vijnana. Asanyasata. Anyway, I won't go into that, confuse you enough. Yeah.
Sometimes some teachers talk about two-rooted beings. Is that something that comes from the scriptures? Would you have the three roots?
Oh yeah.
And they say there are some beings that have just two roots, like maybe mentally disabled people or something. They sometimes say they don't have that delusion faculty, which could be like developed in wisdom or.
I think they always say they analyze it about the delusion or arahats. So it's sort of they have delusion there, but just wondering, can you have just pure will, or just no? I think you have to have the three roots.
Mm-hmm.
Now maybe they have like two roots of just dominant, the other one is just.
Well, they're just explaining that those beings can't get enlightened because they don't have that one root working. So the delusion can't change into wisdom.
I see what you mean, yeah. Okay, that's why I'm looking at it. I understand what you mean now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Buddha's ever said that, but that's okay. Okay, now Sankaras. Saying good friends, as monks delight in rejoicing in the venerable sacred words, there's another way there might be friends. When fellow noble disciple understands formations, sankaras, as origin, cessation, or leading cessation of formations, and that way he is one of right views rather than through down. Remember, some formations create consciousness. What are formations? As origins, cessation, or leading cessation? There are three kinds of formations: bodily, verbal, and mental sankaras. With the arising of ignorance, I like delusion, there's the arising of sankaras. With the cessation of delusions, the cessation of sankaras. Already the cessation of sankaras is another eightfold path. So this is the delusion creates these sankaras. And again, like you can see here, bodily, verbal or mental. Sankara and karma are very closely, this is karmas in the workings of doing things, good karma, bad karma stuff. We're very closely connected. Mental karma, so bodily karma, verbal karma, mental karma. This is actually what the creative force. Another way of looking at it is craving. Craving and karma. Craving makes the karma go this way or that way. This is sankharas. And the cessation of the delusion is cessation of sankharas. And is there another way? Yes. There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands this avijja, delusion, this is the root cause. The origin, cessation, the way it is the cessation. Then they're one of our views. So what is this delusion? What is its origin, cessation, where it leads to cessation? Not knowing about suffering, not knowing about the origin of suffering, not knowing about the cessation of suffering, not knowing about the way it leads to cessation of suffering. This is called delusion. This is why earlier said, anyone who really understands the Four Noble Truths, there it is a spring in it. Not understanding that these things are suffering. If you understand that sense of suffering, you always want to get involved in it. You understand that existence is suffering, you always want to get reborn. But after a while, you see the seed. They had a great simile of the Buddha, of the man, it's in, I forget what sutra it is in, the man who was blind, who was sold this oily rag by a con man who said this was like a great silk Benares cloth. And he went around, he paid a lot of money and said, wow, look at my, you guys are wearing this really nice cloth. And they didn't sort of tell him, it was just an oily rag he'd been sold because he was blind. And then one day his blindness was cured, and when he saw this con man had sold him this oily rag and told him it was a beautiful cloth, he was very upset. In the same way that when your eyes are opened by the Buddha and you can see the Dharma, I'll be sold an oily rag. Sex, pleasure, body. And I thought it was a beautiful thing.
You get very common.
Sorry?
Is yourself the con man?
Yeah, you're the con man, yeah. That's called avijja. The dodgy brother. Yeah?
In the sankhara thing towards, the sankhara that leads to delusion, and the sankhara in the panchapada and kandas.
That's right, yes. So they say that one is like the active form, the causing, and the other one is maybe the sort of result. So in the sankharas, in the active form, this is what creates, and it's created this sankhara of the khandhas right now. So the creator, the creating, and the created. So that's one way the Bhikkhu Bodhi was explaining it. So the sankhara, the active force, and what is actually created? So it's created the five khandhas, one of which is the sankhara, and that goes on creating more things. So you will something, and that creates the ability to will in the future, which creates more ability to will, more ability to will. So it keeps on going on and on and on.
So the proximate cause of will is will?
In a sense, yeah. Because once you get into that, it becomes habit, as they call it. And especially if you've been successful with your sankhara, and you've got a PhD, and you've got sort of success, and people think, look up to you, and say, I've achieved this, look at me. And that means you're even more willful. So be careful. Successful people find it very difficult, they can go there. So when you get frustrated and things don't go your way, that's so wonderful. Finally you realise you're out of control. Is it a volition that you want to look at it and you want to do something with it? That's why it's so hard to look at something without interfering with it. That's why I say make it a nimitta in meditation. You can't leave it alone. The sankhara gets in there and owns it and manipulates it and does something with it. And that's the problem, you can't sort of stop it. So what did we get up to? Delusion. Okay, not knowing about suffering is what delusion is, or ignorance. With the arising of these taints, that is an interesting one, these taints, these are the outflows, so-called, the asvas. The arising of our outflows, this is arising of delusion. The cessation of these outflows is the cessation of delusion. The way to the cessation of delusion is just noble eightfold path. When the noble disciples thus understood delusion, its origin, cessation, the way it is the cessation, they here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, to the noble disciples, one of the right views, one of his true Dhamma. So the taint, this is arsenal. Remember, I like to get closer to the original meaning, this is the outflights of the mind. That's a great way of looking at it, because when the mind goes out, you get deluded. You're not actually looking at where this is all coming from, you're looking out there rather than in here. You don't actually see, you know, that this is suffering. You just look for the next bit of happiness and flow out into the next moment. And realize that this is suffering, this moment. And the outflowings out of this moment, out into the world, that's the origin of the delusion. So going inwards against the outflowings. What is this moment? What's it like? Getting inside of it. Where's it coming from? That's where one ends the delusion. So, but this the outflowings, that's actually what they really mean, this different types of outflowings. So in good friend, amongst the life and rejoicing of venerable disciples, words, they ask them a further question. But then might there be another way in which a noble disciple is what a wife views? View is straight to his unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and as wise as true Dhamma. There might be friends. When says a noble disciple understands the outflowings, the origin, cessation, the way leading cessation of the outflowings, in that way, that one of right view, whose view is straight, whose unwavering confidence in the Dhamma is arrived at true Dhamma. And what are the outflowings? The origin, cessation, where leading the cessation? There are these three outflowings. I was calling that almost like the cause of the outflowings. The outflowing of sensory desire. The mind goes out to seek for satisfaction in the sense world. That's what the main one. And the outflowing of being. Actually, to exist, we have to go out to show we're here. Sometimes people have to speak just to show they're still around. They have to do something just to show I'm here. So that's the outflowing caused by, you know, the desire to be, and obviously the outflowing of ignorance and just stupidity, especially the idea of I am. With the arising of delusion is the arising of the asuras. With the cessation of delusion, the cessation of the asuras. So here actually it's said, they've come around here, that delusion is caused by the outflowings are caused by delusion. So eventually when you go to this causal sequence, you know, backwards, you have to come to some sort of circle over there, otherwise it goes on forever. So these two things, they wind around each other, outflowings and delusions. And what's the way in the cessation of the outflowings? It is the Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, action, right vivid effort, mindfulness and stillness. When a noble disciple has thus understood the outflowings, the origin, cessation, the way in the cessation of the outflowings, they can entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, underlying tendency to aversion, extirpate the underlying tendency to view and conceive I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of that dukkha. In that way, to a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, whose unwavering confidence in the Dhamma is the right view to the Dhamma. So there, if you summarize it all up, you've got from the outflowings and delusion, they work together. And what the delusion is not understanding the Four Noble Truths. The outflows, you don't stay inside, you go out and do things. And from that delusion, so there we have that means we again we're doing something, the sankhara is created. And that creates the vijnana, especially the consciousness of the next life. And from the delusion, together with the sankharas, we create the karma for a new consciousness in the next life. With that consciousness, we'll always have to have the nama rupa and the six sense bases, the contacts, and the Vedana. That has to be there. And if that Vedana together with delusion, that will create the craving. Which will be the fuel which makes more stages of existence and we get reborn into those states of existence. And with that rebirth, the old age, suffering and death, and we're going around again with more suffering. This is the called dependent origination. It just shows us how this process of rebirth keeps on happening. And especially that the rebirth is, you know, the suffering. And why the Buddhism said to end rebirth is to end suffering. Because birth is suffering. We can't get out of it. So eventually the idea of trying to manipulate your life, now you're born, to have no suffering, it's an impossible task. With wisdom, with compassion, you can actually lessen the suffering in this life, but you won't be able to eliminate it. So it is basically a flawed existence. So if you really want to have freedom from suffering, there's only one way, and that's get out of samsara, stop getting reborn. So how do you get start getting reborn? We can find the cause of rebirth for all of this. Starting out with delusion. Delusion together with these outflows. And how do we end that? Eightfold path. When you practice the Eightfold Path, the mind doesn't go out anymore, it goes in. When you practice the Eightfold Path, the delusion disappears. And with it, the sankharas, you don't do anything, you don't create things anymore. With the sankharas, the craving finishes. With the craving finishes, you don't create fuel for more rebirth, you don't create more states of existence. So there's no more rebirth for you. At the end of this life, you must always have the consciousness and the nama rupa and the state spaces and the contact and the vedana. You're stuck with that. Because craving is ended, you don't create more fuel. Which means, just like the oil lamp has run out of fuel, so the flame goes out. That's called parinibbana. So that's dependent origination. And the reason why Sariputta mentioned this in the Samaditti Sutta is because the Buddha also once said, I forget which sutta it was, the one who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination. The one who sees dependent origination sees the Dharma. And this is actually the heart of the Buddha's teachings. How it all works. And what is this mind? What is consciousness? What is Vedana? And how the whole thing develops because of craving. And also adds, usually have the 12 steps to dependent origination. And here, because in Sariputta, sometimes the people think you always have to have 12, always have 31 stages of existence. That's just one way of looking at it. And here you've got 13 steps of dependent origination, with the 13 being the asuras. And you can see this is a beautiful teaching because this is actually showing just how the mind goes out and almost creates delusion, and delusion creates the outflows, how they work together. In other places, the 12 steps, it's almost as the asuras almost included under the delusion. So, now that was a very deep and powerful teaching. That's why we're leading it to the end. We've got another one coming next week, this famous Satipatthana that's coming up next time. But before we finish, any questions on Samaditi Sutta? The karma, it can be in two places, but the karma can be in the sankhara, and this, because sometimes they actually call that the karma formations. Sankara, that's the main place, but also when we crave, we make karma. So it's also part of craving as well. That's why the other way of looking at dependent origination, they almost combine it together. Blinding by delusion, is it bound by craving, we create more rebirth. Now, and that's perhaps most powerful, the avijja and the craving. Focusing on those two things. Those two things come together, they create sort of the problem.
Sometimes when I think the bottom line, you have to weigh out, because it sounds like a really tighten the box that we're in.
Yeah.
And every time you try to get out, there's something that stops you.
Eightfold path.
Sorry?
Eightfold path.
Is it wisdom?
Aha, right. This is it's a great question. And the answer in each one of these, the way out is Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. Not just being kind, not being mindful, not doing jhana, but the whole package is necessary. So it's nice because it's easy to remember. What do we have to do? Take your Eightfold Path. Jiva Samadhi Panna. You need your precepts. I mean, you need your at least your understanding of Dhamma, the basic samadhi, right here. You need your sort of your effort, your mindfulness, your stillness. Put all that together and it all works. Not necessarily because, I mean, this is said somewhere, I forget where, but for example, it's like you read the Buddha's teachings. I mean, the Buddha was enlightened. So by the mind reading the Buddha's teachings, or the mind or the lay person reading the Buddha's teachings, they can put a lot of this out of mind. So actually, it's almost like you're in the mind, but you're using sort of like a crane, which is operating a crane, which is your dry air. But obviously, it's nowhere near as powerful as the teaching coming from someone who's understood. That's why, basically, that I think somebody says if you don't, if you're not a student of mine, then either just read from the sutras, or just say what you've heard from other people asking you. But don't just take from your own person. And that way, the people can help. It's obviously best if you're a student of mine.
So the Dhamma will keep going even if there's only one or two areas left in the world.
That's right, yeah. So remember, if all the areas have disappeared from the world, then maybe another area might get reborn. And they've been screaming in the last life and come along and get things going again. Mm-hmm.
Just by reading, I mean, just by reading, I might just keep that relying on the Buddha's teaching and keep the Dhamma will going.
We keep the Dhamma will going, but remember there are many people who live because the Dhamma will for going a long time, they become streamers or life returns. And then they come in that realm, disappears, and they come to be reborn as well. So there are areas. So each student has a pattern in this life, and then you've got another area. So it's not hard, it's a pretty good system.
If we say there's nobody in here, and there's no control, that's all you can, isn't that kind of sort of bring up the danger of fatalism? Or I can't do anything anyway, I can't influence our path by getting enlightened.
Yeah, well, if it's coming just from the idea of like a concept rather than a realization, then it's very easy one to misunderstand it and take it to be sort of childhood irresponsibility. But if it comes from the right place and it's the I who's disappeared. So the whole idea of that no, I can't do anything or I can do anything is totally disappeared. And we said the reason why the defilements come up, why people do misbehave, is being totally undermined. So you can tell if a person's really understood. Whether they just haven't got any greed, hatred, delusion. Especially like the greed and hatred. So there's no I in there, there's no way to get angry, there's no way to get faith, nothing to lose in. That's actually how you know you're doing it correctly. And you can test it temporarily, because if you really do let go of the doer and the controller, you'll just get very peaceful very quickly. But if you think you're letting go, very often you just get restless, you get tired, you know what to do. You haven't really let go of the life. You just let go of something else. You know if you let it go, because the whole world gets very peaceful and spiritual. Okay, it's been a long one, but a good one, I hope. And coming soon, next week, is the Satipatthana Sutta. And if you've heard it before from other monks, you will not hear it the same way from me. It's always made a difference. It's not saying it's better or it's worse. It's nice to have it different. Different way of looking at things. Okay. So now we can... before we finish off, you did have a question for me in the kitchen when I was going to be talking with Dhammarathna. And what was the question?
The question was the formation of trust, faith, and where do you have that leads to expectation?
Three things, faith?
Well, we will have a little bit of discussion in the kitchen.
Okay. What's it again? Faith?
Trust.
Trust, faith. Yeah.
And how does it do expectations?
Okay, yes. It's faith is very dangerous because there's so many people are out there saying they know what they're talking about, and some do, some don't. So you should be very skeptical with your faith, and don't give it very easily. Check things out first of all. And with faith comes trust. And again, many of you have trusted and been sort of let down. So again, trust has to be very, very carefully given. And when you have faith and when you have trust in something, the expectation will come, well, if I do this, then what this person says will happen, will happen. However, the expectation, if you have faith and trust in a good teacher of Dhamma, they will say expectation is one of the big problems. So don't have faith in which gives rise to expectation. Have faith which gives rise to seeing into the moment rather than expecting something in the future.
Experience,
being in the moment, or expectation, it literally means looking out. It's another form of these outflows of the mind to expect something. And when you expect something to happen, you're not looking at what's happening right now. I'm looking at the door, seeing what's coming in, rather than seeing who's already in the room. So, instead of expecting, it's not quite right according to English, but I often show it, it's the opposite of inspecting. Expecting is out, inspecting is looking in. So the confidence, the faith, the trust should be in someone who tells you to inspect rather than expect. I don't know if that's all answered anyway. I'll give you something else to talk about tomorrow night. Okay. So whose turn is it now to do the hand on my hand? Okay. Okay, I'll do.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.